Hello, everybody. Welcome back to an episode of the Politatine Podcast. My name is Damon Galvin, and I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Zane Balian.
It's great to be here today.
That's awesome. And with us, we have an amazing guest, someone that we've had on the program before, and we're very lucky to have back with us again. His name is Simon Antholt. And Simon, if you want to take a second to introduce yourself to our audience.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Damien. It's great to be back again. What about me? Well, I'm interested in countries. And I'm interested in how people see countries, how they perceive them, and what the impact of those perceptions is. I do a lot of research in this area. I also publish something called the Good Country Index, which tries to measure how much good each country on Earth does to the rest of the planet. So instead of measuring how well countries are doing, how much money they're making, or things like that, this one measures how much good they do.
Yeah,
and other stuff as well, but those are the main things.
Yeah, go ahead. And do you want to explain just exactly how it does that, what it takes into consideration to determine what a good country is?
Well, it's composed of 35 different data sets, most of which come from the United Nations family. So we use UN data simply because the UN is the only organization that measures reliably and robustly and in detail the behaviors of 100 plus 200 countries every year. Unfortunately, there's no other organization that has the clout to do that. But it's good data. And so basically, we've selected 35 data sets that measure activities that countries engage in that either harm other countries or the planet or nature, or else they do good. And those come in seven different areas. So, for example, there's peace and security. How much peace and security do you export to the rest of the world? Or how much hostility, aggression, violence do you export? And then there are other ones like culture. Are you good at sharing your cultural activities, your art, your traditions with other countries? Because we think that's a good thing to do. Or do you keep it all to yourself? And so on and so on. So there are seven of those subcategories, and it adds up to an overall ranking. How good is your country?
Now, how do you look at the methodology when considering these different criteria? How do you take something that could be considered more subjective, whether a country is good or bad, and turn that into quantifiable numbers?
Well, the quantifiable numbers are already there thanks to these big organizations, as I say, mostly UN organizations, because they do these measurements. So they're, although these may sound very subjective, in fact, what we're measuring and what we're mixing together are very tangible activities. Like, for example, how many people did you kill outside your border last year? That's very tangible and very objective. What all of those data sets adds up to is something that can be very subjective, and we can discuss it for days on end. But these are not opinions that we're measuring. They're actual policies, activities, behaviors.
Now, has the data sets you've been using to measure what countries are using to create the Good Country Index, have those data sets changed over the course of the index?
Not a lot. I mean, every now and again, we have to make some changes, either because a particular data set is no longer being collected, so we have to replace it with a new one, or because we find something better. I mean, the Good Country Index is a work in progress, and it's been a work in progress since 2014. This is a very difficult thing to measure. And to be perfectly honest, there isn't enough good data out there to really measure it properly. So we take a very relaxed view about this. If a really good data set comes along that wasn't there in a previous year, then we just add it in. So it does mean you have to be a little bit careful about making too many assumptions about trends over time, because the data sets have changed. So you have to do that calculation quite carefully. But apart from that, the advantage of doing it that way is that you have a constantly improving metric.
Yeah, and something interesting that I remember us talking about the last time we were on the show, it was in the midst of the 2020 election, and we'd been analyzing a little bit the impact of the Trump presidency. And so I guess one question that I wanted to to ask you is how has that changed? How has the United States perception, you know, by other countries changed under this new administration? Has it changed at all? Is it substantial, or is it, you know, falling in line with trends that we've seen in the past? Because I know a comment that you've made in the past is that a lot of people don't necessarily like to hear where their country falls on the good country index, or on the contrary, they're offended by another country ranking higher. But what is it for us Americans? What do we have? What do we have to be perceived by?
Well, you mentioned perceptions. If we want to look at how perceptions of countries are changing, we have to go to my other index, the Nation Brands Index, which is something very different. It's an opinion poll. And we go to 60,000 ordinary citizens in 20 countries around the world, and we ask them a whole series of 50 questions, measuring their perceptions of the USA and 59 other countries. So we say, for example, if you were to buy a product made in this country, would you expect it to be good quality and worth a lot of money or not? Would you like to go on vacation to this country if cost were no object? So this way we measure perceptions of countries, and perceptions of the USA, they were pretty negative under the Trump presidency. Trump was not a popular president internationally speaking. There were relatively few countries where Trump appeared to be admired as the head of state of the US. And when the Trump presidency ended and Biden came in, the numbers recovered a little bit. But I think that the old days when the US was the most admired country on the planet year after year after year after year, number one, those have now gone, and perhaps they've gone forever. Typically, the US now ranks somewhere between 7th and 40th in the rankings, depending on how mad people are feeling. But those top rankings, no, the most admired country on earth is no longer the USA. It's actually Germany most years.
I know that with fluctuations of how people look at America, those fluctuations, although they've continued, the trend has been in some ways quite consistent, with Democratic presidents usually having higher international polling of American resident or of the United States is usually higher during a Democratic presidency, while both during like the Bush and the Trump years, you saw the perceptions of America decline substantially. But what I wonder, though, is when we're looking at the Good Country Index, do we see that similar fluctuation with Democratic and Republican presidencies reflected in the actual Good Country Index, or is that just a matter of perception?
It's an interesting question that you ask. The difference in perceptions, I think, comes from the fact that, generally speaking, Democratic foreign policy tends to be more internationally minded. Republican foreign policy tends to be somewhat more hostile and somewhat more selfish. America First is not something that Donald Trump invented. It's been pretty much the stance of every Republican president since records began. So, as you rightly say, that those perceptions should fluctuate between Democratic and Republican presidents is not really surprising. Whether that's visible in the actual behavior of the country as measured in the Good Country Index, it's a little bit harder to say because there's a longer lag. The thing about perceptions is that they're instant. So when we measure when we run the Nation Brands Index every year around about September, October, what we're measuring is what people are feeling about the country right at that point when we run the study. The Good Country Index tends to be about 4 to 5 years behind time. And there are two reasons for that. One is because these big UN data sets don't get published until about 4 or 5 years after the collection of the data is originally made, because it's a huge task, right? If you're counting, export performance in Sierra Leone, that's a 5-year process to get those up-to-date numbers. So by the time they come to me and we can start feeding them into the Good Country Index, 4 years has already passed. But then you've got to bear in mind that those changes in behavior, in many cases, are also operating on a delay. So it's not like a new president comes in and instantly everything the country does is different. It quite often takes a few years before those new policies are actually detectable in the new behaviors of the country. So you could be looking at a 10-year lag in some cases before we actually know. So incredible though it may seem, it's probably a little bit early to say whether the Trump presidency has had an impact on the position of the US in the good country index. It has gone down, but it's also gone up. It's quite volatile from year to year. At one stage, I think, what, 3-4 years ago, it was the United States was level pegging with Russia. The US was 41 and Russia was 42. So that was quite a shocking result that relative to the size of their economies, the USA and Russia were contributing around about the same to the rest of the world outside their own borders. The US has risen since then and Russia has fallen quite a long way. But again, you see, we're not yet calculating the invasion of Ukraine in the good country index because that won't feed into the data for another year or two.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of going on this dynamic of Russia's power, you know, falling a bit and some regard, you know, you made the statement earlier that the United States, you know, the years of it being perceived as the greatest nation have maybe gone forever now. And I think that in a lot of ways, some people are suggesting that the United States is kind of taking out this anger of trying to remember, I guess, years past on China. What role do you think this developing conflict that that seemingly getting more and more intense every single day is going to play on not only how the United States is perceived, not only, you know, what the good country index is going to reflect, but just in terms of a actual, you know, tangible consequence that we're going to feel, whether that be in the next 10 years or in the next 15 or, in, hey, you know, maybe even the next 5 or 6.
Well, if U.S. policy to, is indeed to act hostile towards China in order to prove that the U.S. is still a major power broker, it's a mistake, because what we've seen over and over and over again on the Nation Brands Index is that the one thing that public opinion will not tolerate is conflict. And it's very cruel, but we've seen that the image of Russia and Ukraine have both declined steeply since Russia invaded Ukraine. So even the innocent party gets blamed by public opinion when conflict happens. And that's for the reason that I said, it's because public opinion just doesn't tolerate conflict and hostility. So the more belligerent and bellicose the US behaves towards China, the more damage it does to its own image. It doesn't improve its image at all, it damages it. And if this saber rattling, this hostility between these two gigantic powers continues to worsen, both countries' images will be damaged as a result. And some people might very well say, you know, a hardliner will say, who gives a damn? I don't care about our image. What I care about is the reality. How prosperous are we? How strong are we? But the reality of the matter is that image does matter because it feeds directly into a country's ability to trade in a globalized world. And hard power alone just doesn't do it anymore. If you want to prosper, if you want growth, if you want trade, and you want to attract talent, then you have to be admired as a country. People have to like you. And if they don't like you, if they mistrust you, you get nothing. And this is the problem that Russia is facing at the moment. By his own standards, Vladimir Putin has achieved or is achieving some of his objectives in the sense that he's demonstrating that Russia doesn't give a damn about anybody or anything. But the consequence of that is that people are less and less well disposed towards Russia with every year that passes, therefore less and less likely to invest in its economy. And this is completely separate from any political attempts to damage the Russian economy. It's just people's desire to do business with the country is diminishing month by month by month by month. Who wants to go on vacation to Russia anymore? Almost nobody. Who wants to buy a Russian product? If they have a choice, almost nobody. Who would hire a Russian person? Almost nobody if they have a choice. So the damage that Putin has done to the prospects of his country and his citizens simply by going to war is beyond calculation.
Now, I wonder if, I know the Good Country Index only began in 2014, but I do want to think about before the 21st century when we looked at the United States' role in the Cold War. And I want to ask if during that time, considering obviously you don't have the statistics, but I wonder if there is an inevitability that conflict between two great powers, will that inherently lead to a decline in one country's standing, like we see maybe with the U.S. and China now, where there's more hostility and third-party countries are less willing to get involved? Or is the Cold War situation a unique one where with the United States and her allies, there was a much more strong willingness to stand by America and stand by her image? And there was much more, I think you could argue, a righteousness in what the United States, her actions were during the Cold War.
Yeah, really interesting. I wish I had the data. My sense is that public taste in countries and the way they behave has changed in the last 20 or 30 years. My sense is that during the Cold War, when I was growing up, countries were admired for their strength. And the United States was admired because it was seen as the world's bastion against communism. And the stronger the US appeared to be without actually pushing the button, the more people liked and trusted it and felt secure. Those days, I think, have long gone. And if it doesn't sound too trivial to say it, I think war has kind of gone out of fashion. And certainly what I found interviewing younger age groups about the invasion of Ukraine is one of the feelings that comes most strongly out of younger respondents is just amazement that anybody would want to do this weird thing of getting in a bunch of tanks and trying to steal somebody's country. Why would you even do that? Now, the idea of going to war was much more common as a part of the general discourse, as our understanding of human history and human nature and the international community back when I was a kid, and 100 years before that, even more so. So my sense, as I say, I wish I had the numbers and I don't, but my sense is that countries no longer get credit for doing things that might have made them look strong in the past. And one of the things that we're seeing now increasingly is that the traditional major powers, you know, the European powers, the United States, the United Kingdom, these kinds of countries, their images globally are declining ever so slightly year after year after year after year. And the countries that have been the victims of colonial or imperial ambitions are the ones whose images are gradually rising year after year after year after year. So the kinds of countries that people admire today, countries like Australia or New Zealand, which have been the victims of colonial power, or countries in the global south, their images are very slightly improving year after year after year. People are really keen on small marginal countries like Costa Rica. New Zealand is another typical example of that. Iceland, countries. These are what I call the hipster nations, which everybody seems to think now are super cool. And that's almost the opposite of the kinds of countries that people admired back in the 60s, 50s, 40s, and previously. So it's good news. It's really good news because it means that humanity is finally growing up and is beginning to understand what actually makes a useful nation. A useful nation is one that makes peace and protects the planet and does its best to provide security for everybody, not just for its own citizens.
I wonder if this trend, this recent trend, is exemplified by a lack of ideological rhetoric that comes out of the great powers these days. And I think to take China, for example, although China is a communist country, they're not like the Soviet Union in trying to push a certain ideology upon other countries. Even with the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, on both sides with the West and with the Russians, it really isn't a larger ideological mission, but it's mostly an expansion of domestic ideological concerns. And I wonder if since the end of the Cold War, the lack of international messaging by the United States, for instance, talking about why we're doing this for democracy, why we're doing this for these larger ideals, but instead these days the tension with China is about them being a rising power and us being threatened by their status of rising power. I wonder if that lack of ideological rhetoric that occurred during the Cold War is a consequence of people not really buying these actions that these great powers are taking that are much more interventionist and much more aggressive stage.
Yeah. I think that it was easier for the US and for the other great powers to have their ideological stance and to promote it worldwide back in those days because things were simpler. We lived in a bipolar world. There were broadly two systems there. There was the socialist communist system and there was the liberal democratic system. And to preach your side of that ideology was easily done and generally well received. We now live in a multipolar world. I've often said there's only one superpower left on the planet, and that's international public opinion. And one way or another, the powers are all trying to do diplomacy with public opinion today. And that makes the world a very complex place. And these simplistic ideological messages, you know, we stand for freedom, we stand for control, whatever it is, these governments are not stupid. They know that they're not going to get very far by preaching that internationally. It's also, like some of the other things we've been talking about, somewhat gone out of fashion, the idea of pushing an ideology. I wouldn't entirely accept what you suggest about China not trying to push its own ideology, because depending on how you look at it, in some respects, it does little else. Sure, it's pushing it more domestically than internationally, but that's partly because it has a gigantic domestic population, the size of a significant chunk of the world's population. And that has to be the primary concern of the Chinese Communist Party and the Politburo, because that's their target audience. What the rest of the world thinks about China pales into insignificance from their point of view, compared to what the Chinese population thinks about the Chinese Communist Party. They have to try to keep this gigantic structure together. They have to preserve its integrity. They have to keep those 1.2, whatever it is, 1.5 billion people happy. And that's not an easy task. So I don't think it's altogether surprising that they're not going out there rhetorically preaching the communist system or trying to impose it on too many other countries. But I think that the criticisms, implicit and explicit, of the Western democratic systems are absolutely nonstop. And the latest one, one of the most sinister ones at the moment, or one of the most damaging ones, which is coming out of China at the moment, is the idea that worrying about climate change or worrying about migration or worrying about any of these global challenges is a new form of Western imperialism. And it should be resisted by countries that have any self-respect. And this is a very dangerous line for China to be taking, because basically what they're doing is they're trying to discourage other countries from forming a functioning multilateral international community. And the potential danger of that in the longer term is absolutely catastrophic. It means we stand absolutely no chance of combating climate change or of preventing further wars or any of those big international challenges that are the main concern today.
Yeah, and with regard to actually tackling these international challenges, these global challenges, do you think that organizations like the United Nations are doing enough? And, you know, if not specifically, what could they do more from your perspective?
It would be cruel to say they're not doing enough because they are so hyperactive and so well-intentioned. And in many ways, the United Nations is full of very smart, very well-meaning people who work every hour that God sends them to try and make the world work better, but they don't have an awful lot of success most of the time. So I think the problem is not really, it's not that they're not doing enough, it's that they're not doing the right things. And I think that the UN is, and it grieves me to say it, but it's looking increasingly inadequate to the tasks that it's facing. It seems to be doing things the wrong way. And one of the things that it does quite a lot of the diplomatic and the legal stuff well, as it always has done. But when it comes to what I regard as being ultimately more important, communicating with ordinary populations around the world, getting the message across, persuading people in the right way to change their behavior. This is where the UN really fails, and fails signally. It just doesn't seem to have that communicative ability to reach out to billions of ordinary people and to exercise soft power, to persuade them to change their behavior. And that really has got to be the UN's number one responsibility towards humanity, to understand, to measure, and to persuade public opinion. And it's really not doing a great job. And it seems to me that with every year that passes, it just looks more and more out of touch with the way that people are thinking and the way that they're behaving. So there needs to be a revolution, really, in the way that the UN reaches out to general populations around the world. Because if it doesn't do that, it's going to go out of fashion and it's going to be replaced. And maybe it needs to be replaced in some respects. I don't know. To some extent, it is being replaced in the sense that the international NGO community has taken over so many of those tasks of outreach to populations. The trouble is, if you've got thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of tiny NGOs doing that, the chances of it producing the general effects that we need are very slight.
Now, my hesitation just when it comes to the critiques of the UN is that I feel like sometimes it's unfair to that we expect them to be doing so much more than maybe their mandate was even given to them. And I just think that, to me, I've always seen the UN more as an institution where the nations of the world can meet and solve issues together. And I think fundamentally, if we're at a point politically where we have nations that are just unwilling or uninterested in cooperating and solving issues, then it doesn't, I don't know if it necessarily matters that much, even what the United Nations actions are, if we're not going to ever be able to get US and Russia and China at a table together.
Absolutely right. And it's very important to remember this, that the UN exists and behaves by permission of its member states. It has no authority other than the authority that's granted to it by its member states. So it's remarkable how much it manages to do despite that fact. But if you look at the typical conversation that takes place in pretty much any international summit of any UN body these days, there's so much unwillingness to cooperate and collaborate. You just have to drop in on a UNESCO meeting when they're talking about World Heritage sites, and every single country there just frantically claiming its own historical sites as being the only ones that should be recognized as World Heritage sites, and dissing everybody else's. It's not an edifying spectacle. And to some degree or another, that's repeated pretty much throughout the multilateral organizations. Unfortunately, just when we most needed cooperation and collaboration between the nations, we are going through one of those periodic phases where more and more countries think that it's okay to be selfish and think that it's cool to go around saying, you know, America first, Germany first, Italy first, whatever it is. This is very unfortunate, and you're right when you say that the UN itself doesn't have an enormous amount of power to change that, because these are very big trends, and the pendulum swings backwards and forwards over decades. And what can the UN do about that? I don't know, but it could and should be discussing these things and figuring out what it could be doing. And, you know, I'm sure somewhere in UN Plaza those conversations are going on, but we're not seeing the results of them yet.
And in relation to leaders prioritizing their nation's interests, you've said in the past, we can all come first. And this is something that I've kind of grown to realize as my worldview has expanded over the past couple years. It's this notion that we kind of hold the world to be zero sum, as if in order for there to be a victor, there has to be a loser. And there is this increasing notion that maybe that's not necessarily the case. Maybe it is an absolute sum world where, you know, you can benefit and I can benefit at the expense of no one. But with that being said, I want to ask you as a final question here, if you had just one quote that you could leave us with today, something that's on your mind, something that you feel like, you know, could resonate with not only the audience, but world leaders, anything that you could think of, what would it be?
You know, the thing I want to say immediately, and I will say, I have a horrible feeling that you asked me the same question last time you interviewed me, and I may have given you the same answer. Who knows? It was a long time ago. I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning. If it turns out that the thing I say now is the same thing I said last time, let's just agree in advance that that shows continuity and consistency, right?
Absolutely.
Rather than a senior moment. The one piece of advice I would love to give to the world if I had a chance, if I had a platform for 8 seconds, would be, no, 4 seconds. It is not obligatory to have an opinion about everything. Okay? This, to me, it's in some ways it sounds really quite trivial, but it's actually, the more I think about it, the more it goes to the heart of the problem that we face in the world today. There's so much information about so many countries and so many things going on all over the world that we, all of us, feel a bit overwhelmed by it. Even if we choose to try not to watch too much international news, the fact of the matter is that there's a whole lot of bad stuff going down all the time, everywhere. So much suffering, so many people dying, so many bad things happening. And it's inevitable that we start to feel that in some way this is our fault or our responsibility, or at least it matters to us. And we have to try to form opinions about it. And we have to have something to say on all of these topics. Quick, what's your view on climate change? Quick, what's your view on Ukraine? Quick, what's your view on sport washing in Saudi Arabia? Quick, what's your view on the ruling family in Eswatini? You know, a million different things, and everybody's expected to have an opinion. Everybody makes the same mistake, which is to assume that the sign of wisdom, the sign of maturity, is to have formed an opinion on every subject. Wrong. It's exactly the other way around. The more wise, the more old, the more intelligent, the more mature you are, the fewer opinions you have. Why? Because the wiser you are, the more complicated you begin to understand things really are, and therefore having an opinion becomes less and less easy. You shouldn't have opinions on every damn thing. I think I have opinions on about 2 things in the world now. I've boiled everything down to 2 opinions. So what should you have if you shouldn't have opinions? Well, you should think. You should think constantly. And you should not succumb to the temptation of reaching a conclusion, because the wisest men and women on earth don't reach conclusions on these subjects because they're so, so, so difficult. So people take shortcuts, right? They say, oh, damn, how am I ever going to form an opinion about everything? I know what. I'll buy the album called Right Wing Politics, or I'll buy the album called Left Wing Politics, or I'll buy the album called, whatever it is, Libertarian Politics. And you buy that album. You don't buy a single track anymore. You buy the whole album. And so you've bought into an instant opinion on birth control. You've bought into an instant opinion on the proper role of government and the proper size of government. You've bought into an instant opinion on the major tenets of religion. You buy the whole bundle. And you say, those are my opinions because I'm right wing. Those are my opinions because I'm left wing. By the way, I don't like you because you belong to the other tribe. And I don't care what you say or what you think, your tribal affiliations or the color of your skin or the gender that you appear to be is enough for me to be able to place you in that particular container and say, my opinion is you are worth nothing because those are not my opinions. This is, you can call it whatever you want. You can call it prejudice. You can call it stupidity. I think it's just laziness. because it's so much quicker to dismiss an entire race, an entire religion, an entire political persuasion just on the grounds of that one thing. It's so much harder to look at a person individually and say, okay, Damien, I want to get to know you and I want to judge you as Damien, not as whatever other affiliations that you may claim, because I'm not interested in your affiliations. I'm interested in you. Now, that takes me a whole lot longer. I've got to take the trouble to speak to you, to get to know you. So we have to massively reduce the number of people that we know. We can't have 100,000 friends anymore because you can't know 100,000 people. We have to boil right down to the 5 or 6 or 10 or maybe in extreme cases 20 or even 30 people that we know well. And we know them well enough to be able to judge them as individuals and not as members of a clique, not as members of a race or a religion or a political persuasion. That, I think, is what we need to do. So the way into it is to remember, forget opinions. You don't need opinions. What you need to do is you need to get to know people and you need to understand what they're like as individuals and judge them as individuals. It's hard work, but it's fun. That's why it's good being human.
Absolutely. And well said, Simon. And again, I want to thank you so much for joining us once again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. And if you want to take a second to shout out anything that you're working on or something that you think people should check out, go ahead.
My gosh, no, I've got nothing. I'm nothing to sell today. Nothing to sell ever. If people want to look at the Good Country Index, I'm always happy for that. The website is good.country. There's a whole bunch of other stuff there that people can look at if they're interested. And I'm grateful for any visits. I like people to look at the index. It's there to be looked at.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much. And thank you, Zane, for joining me for another episode of Politine. And with that being said, to all of our listeners, thank you guys for tuning in once again. If you guys want to check out anything that we're doing, be sure to head over to the oxinstitute.org website and you can catch up with all things Politine as well as other interesting content being put out by a host of different creators. Thank you.